It's the weather outside of our region that gets the attention of scientists these days. The Arctic is finishing up its warmest winter ever. The northernmost weather station on land in Greenland recorded 60 hours above freezing in the month of February. In the past, it only got that warm for minutes, it seems. The numbers continue to add up to the world's climate changing, and carbon in the atmosphere gets the blame. So reducing carbon output makes sense. That's why we're frequently talking about emissions. But there's also talk of removing carbon already in the air, negative emissions. And to help understand those concepts, we turn to Christopher Field, who is a professor of biology and earth system science at Stanford University and the director of the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. Dr. Field, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeffrey. Thanks. Nice to be here.
So your research involved working with the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Tell us about some of what you've been doing.
Well, most recently, my group has been trying to figure out what our options are for rapidly decreasing carbon emissions and potentially removing carbon dioxide from the air so that we can really get ahead of the climate change issue and stop the warming.
So based on the current IPCC models, I mean anybody's models really, if we stopped using carbon-based fuels today, would the temperature rise stop?
The answer is yes. There are slow feedbacks in the Earth system that, I mean, we have a few years of inertia when the heat gets redistributed. But basically, if we stop emitting carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases, the warming will stop. We've already seen warming of around 2 Fahrenheit. And if we were to stop emissions today, we might see another few tenths of a degree, but that would be it.
All right, but the issue is that there's so much carbon up that we need to remove some? Is that the point we're looking at?
The basic issue is that every year the world emits about 50 billion tons worth of heat-trapping gases. That 7 billion people is about, 7 tons per person of equivalent of these gases going into the atmosphere. And the real challenge isn't what we've done so far. It's what we're going to do in the future. And even if we are very, very ambitious about decreasing the rate of emissions, something we haven't seen yet, we're still going to have some decades of need to depend on fossil fuels for transportation, for buildings, and for making things for industry.
All right. So the fact is that we can't stop right away, and the buildup of carbon dioxide is just too great.
The more warming we get, the more impacts we're going to see.
So let's talk about negative emissions and negative emissions technology. NET, is this the usual acronym for this?
That works.
Mm-hmm. How developed is anything out there right now?
Well, the important thing to remember is that negative emissions includes a very wide range of processes. At the simplest end, growing a forest is a negative emission technology. Growing a forest means that carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere is removed using the power of sunlight for photosynthesis to make trees. So we know a lot about negative emissions that way. And we also know that the cheapest way to do negative emissions is to do a better job protecting forests and growing forests. And one of the really interesting features of the whole set of negative emissions technologies is many of them use plant growth as the engine for removing the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. You can think about more complicated processes, ones where we grow plants, either grasses or trees, and use those for energy and then capture the carbon dioxide and put it someplace where it protected from the atmosphere. Or you can think about purely industrial processes. It gets more and more expensive and more uncertain as we go from the purely ecological end to the purely industrial end.
Christopher Field, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of biology and earth system science at Stanford University, director of the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment, and has done a lot of work for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about negative emissions technologies, 800-838-3760 to join by phone. Our emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. So what you were just talking about, well, we would grow things that we would use for fuel. This is BECCS, isn't it? Bioenergy Carbon Capture and Storage?
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And the core idea is, let's imagine we're growing a fast-growing tree species. We have plantation or a natural forest. That forest grows by photosynthesis, removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Cut the trees. You can think about just throwing them into a power plant. Electricity comes out one end, and out the smokestack, that CO2 would be returned to the atmosphere. But we could capture it and compress it and pump it down into, for example, a depleted oil and gas formation underground, where it would be locked up, hopefully, for many centuries.
Well, it seems like you'd have to have a couple of things working together there. A climate appropriate for growing the plants that would be good fuels, geology underneath that area where the burning goes on to be able to have it stored, that sort of stuff.
That's right. And, well, as you know, the United States, especially the Pacific Northwest, has some wonderful climates for growing trees. It's not the best place in terms of these formations that are suitable for storage, but the U.S. in general has many areas where we know there are underground formations that can hold large amounts of liquid carbon dioxide.
Are there good models already running, good tests up for bioenergy, carbon capture and storage?
We know a lot about the two big pieces, the biomass energy piece and the carbon capture piece. The reason we know about the biomass energy piece mainly has to do with the forest products industry, but also a lot of agriculture. And then the carbon capture and storage piece, the oil and gas industry has done a lot of the work for us, because one of the main techniques that's being used now to get especially sticky oil out of formations is to pump carbon dioxide through these formations. It's a process called enhanced oil recovery. So the oil industry knows about the carbon capture and storage. The forestry and ag industries know about the biomass production. And around the world, we're seeing more and more biomass used for energy, either for liquid fuels, ethanol that's mixed with gasoline, or to produce energy directly, electricity directly, which is what's happening in much of Europe. So we know the pieces, we just haven't put them together.
That's interesting to think that that it's the petroleum industry that knows something about putting carbon dioxide into the ground, but of course they're using it to get more petroleum out of the ground and therefore burn more fossil fuels.
Exactly. I didn't say they were using it for something that was helping the climate.
So I mean, and does the carbon dioxide stay down there? It is heavier than air, right?
So when carbon dioxide is pumped into these geological formations, there's good evidence that it can stay down there for many centuries. The oil and gas that are underground have typically been there for hundreds of millions of years, and those are very tight geologic formations. The big problem that we face, unfortunately, is the fact that the oil and gas industry has drilled tens of thousands of wells that have penetrated these rock seals. And one of the things we would have to be very careful with any future deployment of carbon capture and storage is making sure that the CO2 wasn't coming back out through wells that had been drilled earlier.
Ah, okay. So if you've got some place that's gotten a lot of drill holes in it, there's a good chance you could get some escaping of the carbon dioxide.
Exactly right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's take a call here. We have Rika in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking carbon capture, carbon removal with Christopher Field from Stanford.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, if we want to grow plants in order to capture more carbon, one of the first things to do is reform water rates to actually charge for the actual cost of production of water, which is mostly overhead. Overhead be covered by the base rate and unit costs covered by unit prices. Yeah.
Are we talking city water, or irrigation water, both?
City water. Mm-hmm. City water is big. We've had California burning in the fall and winter and summer and any time of year in the middle of cities, big subdivisions, because they're not able to water their yards. You have big subdivisions of tiny lots with single-family homes that are so close together, they're catching each other on fire.
Uh-huh. Well, it's not just water cost. It's also water availability. When you're in a drought, as California has been for many times in recent years, you got some issues there. Dr. Field, anything in there that appeals to you?
Well, I mean, the caller makes a really good point that in order to grow plants for food or for lumber or for energy, you do need an environment that's suitable for that, and sufficient water is one of the real keys. And one thing that worries me about some of the proposals for future biomass energy scenarios, as I think they're very optimistic about the availability of good land and sufficient water. And so we do need to be aware of the fact that, especially in much of the American West, we don't have unlimited water, and we have lots of demands for it for cities and for industry and for agriculture.
Well, that does raise a great question, because the pressure on forest land right now is to disappear, certainly in large swaths of the planet, it seems like, rather than to have more forests grown in the future.
Well, you know, there are lots of options for doing a better job managing our forests. One of the big problems we have in the West is forests that are especially fire-prone, not only as a result of climate change, but also as a result of past fire suppression. And one of the things that could really result in much healthier forests is removal of a lot of the accumulated fuel. And if we were really smart, we could figure out a way to use that accumulated fuel for bioenergy. And so there are lots of aspects of the biomass energy negative emissions environment where we can get win-wins or win-win-wins.
I'm still trying to figure out some of the equation with bioenergy, carbon capture and storage. I mean, it makes sense that obviously you gain something in carbon removed from the atmosphere in the growing of the plants, but then when you burn them and sequester that, you put the carbon in the ground and get it out of the way. It doesn't go into the atmosphere, but, I mean, is it that much of an improvement over just letting the plants continue to grow and absorb carbon dioxide?
At least in principle, you can get two things out of combining biomass growth with carbon capture and storage. You know, plant growth, basically, you can think of as it's a way to do solar energy capture that you get to spread out in time. Photovoltaics are a great technology, but you get the electron right now, and if you can't use it, you're kind of stuck. The great thing about photosynthesis is that solar energy is captured in chemical bonds that are stable and can be used when you need them. And so when you grow plants and let them accumulate biomass, accumulate carbon, you can think about storing solar energy, and then if you and convert that into electricity, you get to use it when you need it. That provides energy for the grid. And then if you capture the CO2, you've got a net movement of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere into this storage. So at least in principle, if you did it smart, you'd have energy for the grid, you'd still have healthy forests, and you'd have less CO2 in the environment, the sort of triple bottom line. If you just grow a forest, you get the healthy forest, and you've removed some CO2 from the atmosphere, but you haven't gotten the energy into the grid, so you've gotten a double bottom line out of that approach.
We are talking about carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere and the technologies that exist and are at least being thought of with Christopher Field, professor of biology and earth system science at Stanford. He is the director of the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment and has done lots of work with the IPCC. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 and by email it's jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Jenny in Roseburg. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. So the professor has said a few times in principle, and I'm not an expert and I can't really quote too many facts and figures, but I've heard a lot and read a lot around the calculations involved and that biomass is not net neutral on carbon if it's more than 50 miles away from the source. And I saw a map that showed a huge gold rush of biomass plants trying to be built for tax breaks up all bunched around I think it was, anyway, somewhere maybe up around Seattle, around Portland, I don't remember. And there were too many of them in the area, and they were all fit more than 50. They couldn't possibly get their materials from within 50 miles of all those plants. And then there's the piece about, in principle, oh, you just burn the trees and you just put them in the ground. I mean, you have to haul the CO2, you have to compress it, you have to cut the trees, you have to haul them, you have to build the roads. And here, what that generally means is you cut down native forests, which sequesters a lot more carbon dioxide because people get into a whole gold rush of fiber and burning. So, like, let's just slick off all the old trees and grow little ones and quickly and burn them up. And then you've had a huge net loss. So I can't quote facts and figures, but I've been reading and hearing a lot of material that would back.
All right, so the theoretical versus the practical. Let's get into that.
It's a really good point that with any new technology, you could deploy it in a smart way or you could deploy it in a stupid way. And there are lots of possible development routes for a biomass energy industry that would result in an increase in emissions rather than a decrease. And Jenny makes a really good point that if you spend a whole bunch of fossil fuel trucking biomass around, those are emissions that need to be accounted. And this really only works if the individuals or the entities that are deploying it are really scrupulous about the life cycle emissions, and that means looking at the transportation emissions, looking at the efficiency of all of the conversions, and fitting the biomass into to a framework where the emissions have been tamped down as much as possible in every other part of the system. You know, with climate change, almost every technology can be deployed in a way that's really, really helpful or really, really harmful, and knowing the limits of what each technology can do is a really important part of deploying it in a smart way. But it's the cautionary note is super important.
The cautionary note, okay. Well noted. I want to ask, because we have sort of zeroed in on bioenergy, carbon capture and storage, but there are other systems out there that don't involve the bioenergy part of this. We're actually talking about sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
Right. You can imagine technology processes where the chemical absorbs carbon dioxide and then that's then later removed and compressed and moved into these geological formations. And we know how to do that. Quite a lot of the natural gas that is produced has large amounts of carbon dioxide in it, and there are methods for chemically removing that. The big challenge with all of the industrial methods is it takes a lot of energy to separate carbon dioxide from the air. And so if the energy that you're using to do that is based on a fossil fuel, you're not getting ahead of the game. You're getting farther behind. So it only makes sense to start thinking about what we call direct air capture once we have a vast amount of emissions-free energy. That's not something we have now, so we should be working on the concept, but it's not something that's ready for deployment and won't be until we have abundant emissions-free energy.
Let us take another call. Colin in Medford, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Christopher Field from Stanford. Colin,
hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, I had a question about the controlled burning that we see around the valley and around other places. Seems to be wasteful and putting a lot of carbon into the atmosphere.
All right, good question. Thanks for that.
So the idea with prescribed burns is usually to improve forests and to improve forests in two important ways. One is to decrease the risk of future fires by getting rid of some of the fuel, and the other is to allow the remaining trees, the bigger trees, to grow more rapidly so that they're not choked out by the underbrush and the small trees and the understory. And when they're well deployed and when they're well executed, prescribed burns can be an extremely important part of effective forest management. But they also do entail some risk of wildfires escaping, and they entail some risk of actually decreasing the amount of carbon in the forest if they're not done in a smart way. I would say that the U.S. Forest Service has a very detailed and effective understanding of how to do prescribed burns, and that prescribed burns can be an important part of effective forest management.
So, Chris Field, I have to ask, are you concerned that thinking that we are going to be able to figure out carbon removal technology and make it energy efficient and not create emissions of its own, that the idea that these technologies will mature will make people lazy?
Yes.
Or something else?
A lot of times people describe that as a moral hazard, that the idea that this technology might be mature has the risk that people take the eye off the ball of the emissions reductions that need to happen in the short term. And one of the things that is probably the most important to understand about the prospects for negative emissions technologies is that they may turn out to be a useful part of a broad portfolio. They're unlikely to turn out to be a dominant part, and we certainly don't have information at this point that's sufficient to say we can stop worrying about short-term emissions decreases. Those need to be the highest priority.
And when people think in terms of, well, okay, we'll get this under control at some point and we'll be able to lower the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, the idea that once we reverse carbon, everything will go back to the way it was, is that at all realistic?
It's probably the case that if the concentrations of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere decrease, that the temperatures will gradually decrease. One thing we don't know is what the impacts of that will be. You know, for example, think about a warming Arctic where ports are being built along the Arctic coast, or where indigenous lifestyles are changing in fundamental ways. If the temperature then starts to cool and a port that was built in 2060 and ice-free conditions then has sea ice returning, and what are going to be the impacts of that? And we really haven't thought through the potential for new impacts that come from a cooling climate once we start removing CO2.
What are your thoughts about the Arctic winter, or the lack thereof, that we talked about at the outset of this discussion?
There's no question that we are seeing impacts of climate changes that have already occurred. Many are exactly what climate scientists have been predicting for decades. Some are surprises, and I think the bottom line from the whole package is that climate change is a serious issue that deserves the top priority of the nation and the world, but it's also an issue that we have technologies to deal with, and where dealing with the problem can also result in, you know, multiple wins. We can produce more vibrant ecosystems, we can produce jobs, at the same time we're dealing with the worst impacts of climate change.
So there are opportunities with the threats as well, you're saying?
Absolutely.
Christopher Field, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of biology and earth system science at Stanford University and director of the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. Thanks for the quick lesson in negative emissions technologies today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Take it easy.